Okay, very good. I should be completely back. I'm sorry I had to reboot stuff. This is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I'm net control operator for this Limark technical net. It's been going for over 44 years now. Every Sunday night at 8 p.m. or thereabouts, we sit in front of our radios, and we chat and exchange information. We learn from each other. We teach each other, and we hopefully entertain each other. And I thank you once again for joining me on this adventure. Let me drop for a second, and I will give you the usual links. Okay. If you want to reach me via email, you can reach me by an address, mailbag@ac2gs.com. So any reason to email me, again, it's mailbag@ac2gs.com. If you want to email Paul and ask him a space and NASA-related question, his email address is spacenetreport@gmail.com. We offer a bunch of interesting links, especially hopefully tonight. We're going to do a little short presentation on the Consumer Electronics Show and on some apparently new technology that's been hinted at. So links on that are available, as well as other links. You get to it by text.
WS2N.
Okay, this is most likely going to be a problematic night because, you know, things are a little wonky and falling out of sync, but I'll give it a try as best I can. Anyway, you know the usual links. I was going to mention MyKC2NJI has a great site called amateurradio.tv with archives of the technical net that go as far back as September of 2006. So avail yourself of those archives. Let me drop, and I'll tell you what we got planned. Okay, there's not a heck of a lot going on in artificial intelligence. I think I was hoping for some announcements on the Consumer Electronics Show that was held in Las Vegas this. Usually, they would probably do something. But for some strange reason, it's just the same generic AI stuff. And nevertheless, I put together a little short comment about the Consumer Electronics Show for this weekend that hopefully some people will find amusing and interesting. And it also includes some possibly new technology that was kind of hidden away in a corner of some exhibit from a bunch of guys from Finland. So hopefully you'll find that interesting. So that'll be the first part. The second part will be the usual questions, comments, and topics for discussion. I'll ask people to give me their name and call sign, whether it's amateur radio related or just science and technology, and we'll take them one at a time. Hopefully that should take us to approximately 10:15, and Paul WS2N will join us with a SpaceNet report. That should take us hopefully to 11 o'clock. And I will return to tie a bow on everything and wish you well for the coming week. So that's the plan if everything goes to plan. Unfortunately, since my computer already crashed once, and it's acting a little strange, but hopefully it'll settle down soon. Nevertheless, we'll see how it all works out. So let me drop, and when I come back, we'll talk a little bit about the consumer. Okay, the Consumer Electronics Show is an annual thing. It's been going on forever and ever and ever. It's not open to the public. You got to get some kind of. But it's very well covered by YouTubers. They go all over the place. And, of course, you know, after this, my recommendation for anyone truly interested in the Consumer Electronics Show is to do a search in YouTube, and you'll find a lot of interesting YouTube stories about everything. Unfortunately, not that much kind of new, what you would sort of expect. There were a lot of robots. They weren't terribly exciting, nothing particularly new. There were those strange, creepy sex robot things, for people into creepy things. There were a lot of home control stuff. There was, of course, a lot of television stuff. Thankfully, we didn't get any kind of 8K or 16K ultra-high resolution. They're just building them bigger and bigger. And, you know, some of the biggest screens that they showed cost $100,000. Also, they're using an old ploy that Sharp Television used, I think, about 15 years ago. They decided to stick a yellow pixel among the red, green, and blue pixels. And I'm back. Yeah. Okay. This is going to be problematic. I can tell. If it keeps on doing like this, I'm going to go back to the RF link and let my computer rest a little bit. Anyway, about 15 odd years ago, if anyone remembers, Sharp Television came out with the pseudo revolutionary yellow pixel. It was a disaster, and I don't think you can buy a Sharp TV in New York these days. But nevertheless, despite that, the Chinese have invented a revolutionary technology. They put a yellow pixel in their screen, and I think the same company is also offering a cyan pixel. A surprisingly boring presentation from the people who brought. Okay. Now, here's the interesting thing, though. And it was hidden away, and there is a couple of people on YouTube who were talking about it, but it's very difficult for me to have found originally. It was located in a small company in Finland. The company's called Verge. They had electric motorcycles. They had one last year, and they have one this year. So the Verge motorcycle in and of itself doesn't seem to be that novel, except it's electronic instead of internal combustion. Again, it's in Finland, and the same company, the same group of people have another company that they call Donut Cycle. But they're transmitting or not. Okay, hopefully I am. Anyway, so with a curious addition to their electronic motorcycle that was they already showed last year. And that's something called the solid-state battery. Now, if you guys are familiar with the concept of solid-state batteries, they don't exist in the wild. They're a research type of device. As hopefully most of you know, batteries generally consist of cathode element and anode element, and a liquid electrolyte. You know, it goes back to simple lead-acid batteries work this way, and even slightly more sophisticated version is found in the lithium batteries that we know and love. Solid-state batteries, though, are designed to have a solid electrolyte. They're only in the research phase. They're fragile. They're expensive. And they're difficult to manufacture. Yet these guys say that they're going to just include it in their motorcycle of this It has 30% more energy capacity, so it's lighter, smaller, cheaper, and has a recycle. You can cycle it 10 times more than lithium ion. So it seems to be a fantasy battery. If it's really, in fact, true, it's going to revolutionize the whole concept of rechargeable batteries. You know, if it works the way they say it does and they put it in electric vehicles, your electric vehicle will fall apart long before your battery runs out of cycles. So it sounds very revolutionary, but again, it's a small Finland company. They have 60 employees. Most major battery manufacturers have thousands of employees and billions of dollars of investment that this thing doesn't. They don't even intend to actually patent it and license it out. They want to be the main manufacturer. So how a small Finland company is going to manufacture this type of battery in mass, I don't have a clue, whether it's real or imaginary. Supposedly, in 3 months, they will be shipping their new vehicles with the new solid-state battery. So I'm sure within seconds, major battery manufacturers will buy one and take it apart and try and reverse engineer it. So that's the diamond in the rough that I found this past week for the Consumer Electronics Show. If anyone wants to comment in any way, shape, or form before we go on to the main segment, feel free, hit that push to talk.
November 2, Zulu Charlie.
Yes, John.
Yeah, good evening, Roy. What was the, number one, what was the name of that company again? And number two, as far as solar panels and using batteries, I'm wondering if this will play a big part, if like you say, if it is true. And just as one follow-up, is there anything else on the market besides standard batteries for solar power? So I guess that's three questions in one. The name of the company, if there's anything else besides standard batteries for solar power, and, you know, I'm assuming this battery, when it does come to fruition, hopefully, it also, I'm assuming, would be something great for solar power.
Well, yeah, I mean, basically any kind of rechargeable battery to a degree would be reasonably good for solar power, but I mean, especially this particular one because of its ridiculous number of possible recycles, and that, you know, it's cheaper than lithium batteries. It holds a more charge density than lithium. They didn't really discuss if there was any risks of flammability. The people presenting it didn't really want to go into detail of what the nature of the actual battery chemistry is. It's made by a company that has a couple of brands. One is a donut. That was the original company, I think, that patented the motor that works with the motorcycle. The Verge motorcycle uses a motor that's basically the axle of the rear wheel. So it's built, the motor itself is built directly into the axle that's connected to the wheel. So it's either going to be marketed under Donut Labs or Verge. I think it's a Donut Labs. And as far as other, you know, anything that's capable of being recharged, it might be useful for storing energy through solar cells. You want something that's efficient. You want something relatively that has a long life and a high energy density. And this certainly, if it's real, will kind of be that thing. I've heard a bunch of battery nuts on YouTube kind of fantasize and try and guess what originally, what the nature of the battery really is. Some people think it's just a glorified sodium battery. Sodium batteries have been out for a couple of months now. They have a lot of limitations, unfortunately. They might be able to fix some of them. They might not be able to fix others. But one guy thinks it's a sodium battery. Another thinks it's a supercapacitor. And another thinks it's something called a pseudo-supercapacitor, which sort of operates as partially a capacitor and partially as a standard operating battery with cathodes, anodes, and electrolytes and such. So no one has a clue exactly how it works or if it does work. They didn't actually bring a battery to Consumer Electronics Show. They brought a mock-up of the battery. It was basically just the plastic case that the battery fits in, and they showed what seems to be a video recording of them charging the battery up in their lab. But that could be faked if someone was so inclined. It'll be interesting to see what becomes of this.
Absolutely. Thank you for bringing that to us.
You're welcome. We touched very, very lightly about a year or two ago about solid-state batteries. There wasn't that much to go on. I mean, unfortunately, although there's some interesting aspects that might help, one of the reasons probably why the cycles are much higher, the number of times that you can cycle a rechargeable solid-state battery is because the electrolyte is solid. We talked about dendrites, which are little filaments of the metal on the cathode and anode that sometimes are generated during recharge cycles. And if they grow too great, they short out the battery and undermine the whole principle. But since solid-states have solid electrolytes, there's no real mobility for the dendrites to grow, you know, into the electrolyte because it's all solid. So the underlying concepts of solid state are fascinating. But again, up until recently, most research has indicated that it's expensive and very difficult to manufacture. These guys seem to think that they've broken that secret. So they think that they could scale up on a modular basis. They say that it doesn't contain any rare earths, so you don't have to go to war and fight countries for their resources. They said that, you know, pretty much every continent is full of the stuff that's used to make their batteries. So it'll be interesting to see if anything comes of it. Theoretically, in about 3 months, they'll be releasing it to the public as a product. So we'll see how that goes. Hopefully, if it makes the news again, I'll bring it back in 3 months and tell you what I learned.
Comment.
Sure, Wes.
Yeah. Interesting is how the success of some people, we tend to think it's a success, is immediately criticized by some others. And there's a video, because you mentioned about the donut butter, by The Electric Viking. The title of that video says, Battery Express says, Donut Labs Miracle Solid State Battery is a scam. So I wouldn't even mention that, because everywhere we have people opposing something, whether they have a right to do it or they invent their right to do it, or they simply want to slow down the progress, if there is any progress. But there's an interesting comment in it. Says, Board of Donut Labs is run by main investors, Risto Silasama, ex-chairman of Board of Nokia and founder of F-Secure. Another notable investor is Tanley Tikka, who run Finnish State Development Organization, whatsoever. So, and it looks like there are 50 companies from that comment that are involved in it. If that was a scam, would think there would be five individuals could think it's true, but it's a scam, but not 50 companies. Back to you, Andrexia.
Well, this is very reminiscent, unfortunately, to what we talked about, room temperature superconductors. And you discussed all the people with PhDs who had their name sort of on the research project. It wasn't really, apparently, one or two of the researchers grabbed the report and published it prematurely to get fame. More fame themselves than the other people involved. But, big-time professionals get defrauded all the time. Theramos company, it had Henry Kissinger was one of the trustees, and it was a complete sham. So I'm not saying yay, I'm not saying no. It would have been nicer if they would have brought the battery to the Consumer Electronics Show instead of a plastic mock-up of the battery that doesn't really prove anything. And all they had to show was a video of it charging, and even the video of it charging was a little problematic. They were charging it very fastly. Another very good plus about solid-state batteries in this one particularly is you can charge it to 80% capacity in 10 minutes. So it takes a very fast charge. That's why some people think that it's, rather than being a chemical battery, it may possibly be much more like a supercapacitor. And if it is a supercapacitor, then you have to kind of look at it in a different way than we do batteries, because supercapacitors aren't rated for cycle times. They're rated for age. They kind of get old and malfunction over time, even if you don't use them. So it's possible that there's a couple of gotchas in the design that, generally speaking, the specs are somewhat accurate, but there may be some hidden problems behind the design. That's a possibility as well. It's always good to put a little doubt. If you have a astonishing development, but you don't really show it to anyone, you just report it and, take my word for it. Unfortunately, human nature being what human nature is, a lot of times things go pear-shaped. So, just because some important wealthy people have invested into this company doesn't necessarily mean that it's 100% legit. Only time will tell. If they're able to bring it into sales in 3 months, if they're able to actually scale up the technology, it would revolutionize electric vehicles. Consider electric vehicles. When people need to have their Tesla battery replaced, it costs a lot of money. With batteries like this, there's no cost for changing the batteries. The battery will theoretically last longer than the life of the car.
PhD.
Yes, Jim.
I'm wondering, Roy, was there any of those creepy robots at the Verge motorcycle booth?
Frankly, no. There were a lot of creepy... There was Boston... that famous robot company that's now owned by, it's Hyundai or something. It's owned by some Asian company. And there were all kinds of freaky-looking robots, and there were AI-added stuffed animals, and everything that a person's nightmare would show up at. So there was a lot of that, but nothing, again, that was particularly revolutionary. Nothing novel. It's just more of the same slop.
Sounds like it to me. Back to that.
Yeah, the one particular thing that I liked about Verge is not once in any of their presentations did they mention artificial intelligence, which was a rarity. Almost everything at the show had artificial intelligence, toothbrushes, refrigerators, ice makers. For some odd reason, Samsung will try development dollar to try and sell us all a refrigerator that plays commercials on the front of the refrigerator. I do not know why. I have no interest whatsoever in watching commercials on my refrigerator. I prefer my refrigerator to keep my stuff cold until I need it. That's about it. I don't need it to talk to me. I don't need it to show me a movie. And I certainly don't need it to show me advertisements. But Samsung, God bless them, they keep on showing these refrigerators.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Thinking about the size of the charging cable, the diameter, you know, it would have to be like a double-aught type of cable. You know, if you're going to charge a car battery in 10 minutes, you know, one of these big batteries for an electric car, you know, the amount of amperage that would have to be pouring into that car in that 10 minutes, I would imagine they'll probably have to beep up the size of the diameter of the charging cables. You might not be able to use the existing ones that are out there. I don't know. I just can't imagine something like that, you know. It takes 10, 12, 15 hours. And that's, you know, that people are plugging these things into the house. You know, you plug something like that into your house, you're going to need, you know, a 440 hookup instead of just a 220 hookup to your house. Back to you, Ray.
Yeah, I mean, there's always talk of infrastructure, and they'll have to change the currents to get that speed. Otherwise, you know, if you simply don't have something at that current, you'll just have to charge it more slowly. But, you know, the Chinese cars, I'm told, that partially charge up in 15 minutes. So, you know, it's not quite that miraculous to doubt it, although that's another point of doubt that I have. Their major claim to fame is that video of the battery charging. And yet, as you said, it should be a massive piece of wire. But if you look at it, it looks like something like maybe a 12-gauge wire. So, you know, that's very suspicious. It shouldn't be able to carry that amount of current. And one of the people showing it on a YouTube video suggested that might have just been for very short-term charging periods where, you know, they could get away with it, you know, just as a demonstration, but you know, for long-term survivability, they'd have to use a much thicker gauge wire.
Comment about the butter.
Okay.
Yeah, things about the battery are not old, and there is another guy to be Da Vinci. So we have a Veritasium, we have a few others, and now we have a to be Da Vinci, which has about 800,000 subscribers. And the guy is making videos about what is new and what is important in science and practical science as well. He was trying to describe that first solid state battery, and that was yesterday. He put that video yesterday. Okay, so to be Da Vinci and is investigating the world's first solid state battery. To explain, but I've heard in the news, and that was something that actually caught my attention, the number of charges exceeds two times the life of the vehicle that the battery is installed at. And that kind of wording was present not only in one place, but in many places that I was trying to check the information. Back to you.
Okay. Okay, yeah, I mentioned it twice myself. It's a big selling point for electric vehicles. One of the big pain in the backsides for electric vehicles is the inevitable replacement once you've gone through its cycling life. So the fact that it has, I think, 10,000 cycles, you know, most people just sitting there in the back of an envelope figure that's long after anyone's idea of how long the other parts in the car will survive. So it's a big selling point that you're not going to have to drop $10,000 on a new set of rechargeable batteries 7 or 8 years down the road that you bought the electric vehicle, which is the price that you tend to pay for Teslas and such. So it's a reasonable thing to promote because, you know, it's a great selling point. It's one of the weaker aspects of electric vehicles, the fact that inevitably you need to replace them, and they're rather expensive and not that easy to replace. So it's sort of understandable. Again, the problem may end up being that these solid-state batteries are possibly more like supercapacitors, and supercapacitors aren't rated in the same way that rechargeable batteries are. They're not rated to recycle because you charge a capacitor, you don't really cycle it. And also, it does have an endpoint that's based on simple time. You know, after X number of years past manufacturing, the supercapacitor breaks down, no matter if you recycle it 1,000 times or 5 times. So that might be a gotcha down the road. But they're not really promoting it for electric vehicles right now. The only device that they're going to be selling it in is, at this point, is an electric boutique-level motorcycle called the Verge.
Okay. I have a question for you. If you were to fantasize, actually not to fantasize because you're not this kind of person and you never manifest the such, but just to take, say you project your take over the electric vehicles versus the hysteria, oil hysteria we have now. I mean, what do you think, personally? Back to you, Andrew.
In terms of what? I mean, through the years on the technical net, we've talked about many aspects of electric vehicles. They're interesting. They're innovative in some ways. They're somewhat counterproductive in others. You know, people like the idea that it's not an internal combustion polluting device, but it runs on electricity, and if you kind of go back to electric generators that we have around us, very few of them are nuclear-based. They're mostly fossil fuel-based, and so you're just moving the pollution from the exhaust pipe of your car to where the power generation takes place. So, you know, it's not quite as clean and simple as people promoting it. And I still think it's a useful technology. I think that there's going to be a lot of resistance still as time goes on, as younger people get into the driving business. They will probably have a much bigger interest in electric vehicles. I do not know if they will ever reach 100% or even 50%. You never know. Some other technology might capture all of that later on. But, you know, I find nothing intrinsically terrible about electric vehicles, but they're not quite the panacea that originally people promoted it as, that it's a totally green solution. It's a green solution if you have a magical electric generator someplace. But if you have to supply electricity to charge its batteries, a lot of times you end up back with fossil fuel. So you've just traded places, locations, but it's the same pollution.
So you think you will be more likely tied to gasoline and use of fossil fuel for quite a time, Victor.
Yeah, I would think so. There's a massive infrastructure for fossil fuels, and we're still building them for electricity, and generator technology has not advanced. People are working on the concept of nuclear fusion power generation, and they predict it's only 20 years away, and has been 20 years away for about 60 years. And will probably continue to be 20 years away for the foreseeable future. Eventually, I think they'll figure it out. And when that happens, again, it's going to change all kinds of things. Because now you're going to have a relatively clean way to create power from nuclear fusion. I've mentioned before that I'm a little concerned by the waste heat. These things all generate, they're not 100% efficient, so the byproduct of these power generators are waste heat, and how are we going to get rid of, we're already kind of getting warmer and warmer here on the Earth, so how do we dissipate the extra heat of a lot of fusion generators covering the Earth? That's another technological problem that scientists are going to have to think hard and work a lot to solve.
Yeah, it's a good point. The only thing, how many of them do we need to have in order to see that effect?
Well, people tend to use what they got, so they'll probably use and abuse it. Also, I'm sure if they figure out how to just generally create electricity from fusion, there'll be some research taken into smaller fusion generators. And, it might get to the point of the movie Back to the Future, and the car was running on something that was called Mr. Fusion, kind of like Mr. Coffee of the day. That we just put in some water and such, and it has its own little individual fusion electric generator. So who knows? That's the nature of science, technology, and invention. Things you couldn't possibly imagine will become real things in 20, 30, 40 years. I was one of those kids who regularly read the cover article of Popular Science of, flying cars and such would be all over the place in 20 years back in the 60s. And they almost always got it wrong.
Comment.
Certainly.
KP2BHC. What about thorium reactors? Seems to be undiscussed commodity in this field. What are
we? Well, it depends who you discuss it with. The United States had experimental thorium reactors back in the 60s. It looked like it was very promising, but because nuclear power kind of fell out of fashion, people got very frightened and shut down nuclear reactors, and no one wanted to invest in thorium-based nuclear reactors. It kind of fizzled out. Interesting to see, what they discover and how it works for them. And I'm sure if they're successful, companies like GE that used to make nuclear reactors might be courted into coming back into the field. Fusion is still significantly better than thorium. Thorium is an interesting method. It's intrinsically safer than the present day fission technology that's used in nuclear reactors. But it's not revolutionary, somewhat evolutionary. But the federal government spent a lot of money doing research and building test reactors as far back as the 60s.
It's my understanding it's a much cleaner technology without this, after effect that stays around forever. But it doesn't create the raw material for nuclear weapons, and that's why we didn't go that route. If I'm wrong, say so, but that's what I understand.
Well, again, that was one of the negatives. They're not, you know, I mean, you would need a breeder reactor anyway. So there are ways of building generators based on fission that aren't breeder reactors, that don't produce the fuel for nuclear bombs. So I don't think that was the primary reason. Again, I think, unfortunately, the primary reason was that, you know, while they were, you know, almost finished with their experimental research, the taste, the desire for nuclear fission-based generators collapsed. Thankfully, it's kind of come back. Countries are starting to set up fission reaction generators, but for probably 20 years, you said the word nuclear, people just kind of threw things at you. So I think it was more just the general dislike. It's very, words have great power. I mentioned long ago that once upon a time, magnetic resonance imaging devices were not really called magnetic resonance imaging devices. They were originally called nuclear magnetic resonance devices. But because of that nuclear in the name, they didn't think they could sell it to any hospitals, and so they changed the name. It was very effective, but it was 100% marketing. It had nothing to do with science. Any other comments on the Consumer Electronics Show or solid-state batteries before we move to the main segment? Okey-doke. This is AC2GS with the Limewire Technical Net. We're open for business. If anyone has any questions or comments or topics, please hit that push to talk. Give me your call sign and your first name, whether it's amateur radio based or science and technology. I would prefer if there was amateur radio stuff at the top of it. But again, anyone with any question, we'll put it down on the list. If we have time, we will try to address it as best we can. So with all that in mind, if anyone out there has any questions, comments, or topics for tonight, and I hope that they do, then hit that push to talk.
KD2VHD, amateur radio relay.
Jim recognized. Anyone else want to put their name on the list for tonight?
K2RY, amateur radio.
Okay, David. Anyone else? Okay, hopefully as the night progresses, people will come by, or other people who are sitting there right now will come up with some interesting topic or question for later on. Jim, what do you got for us tonight?
This is a retread. I think I mentioned this before, I'm pretty sure, but I was wondering if there was any updates onto the interesting changes to the 60-meter band. Anybody have any insight on what that's all about? Rather odd, it seems to me. Hold it
right. Okay. Anyone out there know about the 60-meter band and the plan changes? I haven't really kept up with it. Yeah, Jim, I guess no one else kept up with it either.
I drop a tickle. I'll revisit it another time. Thank you. Back to that.
You're welcome. David, what do you got for us tonight?
Allows for a person to eliminate a lot of the noise that they're getting with the other antenna.
Okay, you're rather noisy tonight. I don't know what happened. Maybe you moved your antenna or changed the setting on the radio.
Should I say it again?
Yes, please.
I'm looking at these transceivers that have two ports. One for the transmit receive antenna and one for the second receive antenna. The receive antenna is a certain type that allows the radio operator to
Okay, you are dropping out of the repeater every so often, but I think I understand what you're saying. It sort of depends upon what aspect of this you're talking about. We talked kind of earlier this morning on the 10-meter that there are diversity reception devices. My Flex has two basic receivers, so has two antenna inputs for two separate receivers, and you can put one in your right ear, you can put one in your left ear, you can combine them and adjust the phase relationship between them. So, you know, diversity reception is an option for more than one receiving antenna. You know, it sort of depends upon the quality of both of the antennas. Noise reduction circuits also operate by combining more than one receiving antenna and adjusting the phase relationship. So I think DX Engineering has a really expensive noise canceling device that's effectively just that. It has two antenna inputs and phase controls at the front of the box. Some people like it. Some people find it more work than it's worth. It sort of depends upon the nature of the noise that you experience and the environment that you experience it. You know, some noises are more, reverse engineerable than others. You know, if it's purely random noise generation, it tends to be more difficult. If it's something more artificial, it's usually somewhat more amenable to phase cancellation technologies and such.
The second receive antenna, specifically to eliminate noise, there are certain kinds of antennas that can do that. Then, you know, I saw a video on the YouTube. Ma'am was talking about the settings on your transceiver, you can eliminate noise. So I don't know if it's really worth the trouble to install a specific antenna to eliminate noise. And then, you know, the question is,
David, you said the question is, and then you fell completely out of the repeater.
Yes, can the antenna perform the way you want it to?
Well, you never know. I mean, that's the problem. If it was 100% worked that way, then everyone would have it. And almost no one has those. So in some cases, it might benefit some people to some degree. Whether it's worth the time, the trouble, and the investment, you can only tell after you've tried the experiment. But I mean, is it guaranteed to work? No. Like most things in life, it's not guaranteed. It might help. Will it remove all of the noise in your environment? I'm willing to bet you the answer is no. It'll probably improve the noise somewhat. If that somewhat is worth the trouble, then it's a success. If it's not worth the trouble, then it ends up being a failure.
To the other. actually some of the newer radios are offering a feature of the extra port for the receive antenna. I don't know if it's really that great. I'm very happy with the way my radio works with one antenna.
Well, I mean, I think that's for a different problem. It's not a separate antenna to lessen, per se, your noise. It's an antenna that's more optimized, despite the reciprocal effect, more optimized for reception than for transmission. An example, especially for things like 80 meters or 160 meters, is a lot of people will have one antenna to transmit on the frequency, but will use a beverage antenna to receive because it gives you a better quality reception. But unfortunately, the nature of a beverage antenna does not allow for you to transmit because it has a small resistor at the end of it. Rather than a standing wave antenna, beverages are traveling waves. So the wave travels to the end of that given antenna, and then it experiences a terminal load, and the rest of the energy in it is dissipated as waste heat. So you can use a beverage antenna very effectively as a relatively low-noise receiving antenna, but no one in their right mind would ever use it to transmit. Nice if that was reality, but unfortunately it's not. There are a lot of parameters that you can adjust to modify your reception and in some cases lessen the noise. But is there something you can just turn on that just gets rid of it? No. Different algorithms, again, work for under different circumstances. It's highly dependent upon what your signal strength is. It depends upon what the nature of your background noise is. Is it local? Is it far away? Is it completely random? Is it pseudo-random? Is it terribly non-random? You know, a lot of different factors ensue, and the reason why most radios have, you know, five different noise reduction circuits is because there's no one circuit that does it all. So as much as I would like that kind of switch to just turn it on and poof, the noise goes away, it don't exist. Maybe it'll exist someday, but right now it doesn't.
PhD. Well, the 10 meter net sounded perfectly fine. I didn't hear any noise at all. So it was like armchair copy, you know. So how many times, you know, is it possible to have this kind of a signal response when you can't hear it? And it's just the greatest thing.
Well, when it clicks, and then it's fantastic. But no one in their right mind can tell you that it works, you know, 32.7% of the time. Again, it's highly variable and highly dependent upon a whole bunch of different variables. So one day you could have half of your signal clean up, and the next day 2%. Jim, you wanted to say something?
Yes, not discounting anything you just said, you are 100% on. I agree with it. But there's an interesting development in the world of noise and noise floor and beverage antennas and different receive antennas. The Wycom IC7300 Mark II has two antenna connections, and you can have one transmit, one receive. That's been a thing you could do for all time in ham radio. But never before have I seen a radio that does that right out of the box at a, I don't want to say modest price. You know, it's not an insane price radio. And you can gain the advantages of a low noise receive antenna and an efficient transmit antenna without having a great big cornucopia of widgets on your bench. I think that's a game-changing radio in regards to this particular topic, because there's definitely listening antennas that can eliminate a lot of the noise reception. And I'm no expert in this, but I'm really intrigued by the whole developments in that world. Back to Roy.
Okay, I guess I don't get amazed as quite as easily. There are things called TR switches. They've been around for, I think, 60 years, and they're not really that big. They're a small chassis with a couple of an input and output, and when you transmit, the relay switches the antenna feed to the transmitting antenna, and when you stop transmitting, it releases the relay and connects it to the receive antenna, like a beverage. Also, you know, my 12, 13-year-old Flex 6700 had that capability out of the box as well. So although it's a nice feature to additionally have, and it might save you the cost of a $100 TR switch, you know, I think, you know, that wasn't a terrible price to pay. You know, the problem is people have to put in the slight effort to find an optimized receive-only antenna and set it up in, you know, in the proper places to get it to be able to work. I think that's a lot more work than to just buy a TR switch and plug it in.
All good thoughts. Thanks for letting me input.
Sure, no problem.
Into it, Chief.
Yes, Wes?
Well, I assume that the previous subject is finished, and I would like to have a few words from you about D-Star and DMR in terms of popularity, a difference, which one is more popular and more tend to take over, and which radios have both DMR and D-Star.
Okay, that's a good question. David, did we go through your question completely?
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. KG2RY.
Okay. Well, bunch of little questions there. To my knowledge, there is no radio that is capable of doing both DMR and D-Star. DMR.
Okay.
Okay, do you hear me, Wesley?
Yes, now I can hear you. Go ahead.
Okay. D-Star was a protocol that came up from the Japanese Radio Club and got licensed by ICOM. It's a digital voice mode. It uses a codec. It was probably the first non-commercial digital voice mode that people were made aware of through ICOM. But a little bit later on, Fusion decided to get into the business, and that brought us Yaesu. That brought us Fusion Digital. DMR started as a business protocol. It was Motorola. It was Itera. And once everyone and their brother company had repeaters for DMR and started to buy new ones and recycle, amateur radio operators bought used Motorola stuff and...